Hello, this is Tamiko Faison, your host for Therapy Entrepreneurs and Leaders of Color, a podcast dedicated to showcasing therapy entrepreneurs and leaders of color and supporting them in their roles around the world. Our guest today is Sheila Ivlev. Let me make sure I pronounce that correctly.
Sheila Ivlev.
Okay. Sheila Ivlev is an occupational therapist specializing in mental health and wellness. As a South Asian woman born and raised in San Francisco, she understands health and wellness from diverse perspectives and values the connection of culture and healing. She became a certified mental health integrative medicine provider to incorporate traditional and holistic methods with her clinical education and training. She is committed to removing the barriers to care that keep people from accessing health and wellness services. Sheila is a published author, international speaker, mental health clinical educator, and health and wellness consultant. Welcome, Sheila.
Thank you so much for having me, Tamiko.
I'm so glad you're here. And we were just having this conversation before we started recording, and I feel like we need to rewind. And
I know
what we were just talking about, but I am, I'm thrilled to have you here. Health and wellness is a big and hot topic, particularly in the times that we are dealing with right now. But if you can tell us about yourself, how you became interested in OT, and I'm going to add to that, if you can tell us how you became interested in health and wellness.
Yes. So you've already introduced me. Thank you for that. So I am in I'm in San Francisco, which is in California. And so I am actually currently doing telehealth, and occasionally in person, with a pandemic going on, but I have a business, that's called OT Bay Area. And so I have been in OT for a little over 10 years now, and I've predominantly been working in mental health, similar to you. And I did a lot of hospital-based work, a lot of clinic-based work, and there were just lots of areas lacking. I actually taught at an OT program as well and ran an independent occupational therapy clinic through a clinical mental health course. And so I really got to help the students. It was a student-run clinic. I got to help the students really get into what's most important in the lives of the clients. And that's stuff is not covered by insurance. That's the reality. And so if there's no reimbursement, you can't address it unless you're volunteering your time to do it. So I decided that I'm going to start my own business. I am going to do things my way, which is really just based on the people that I'm working with, what's most important to them, and not focus on, okay, what's reimbursable, what fits within the confines of this institution. And so for me, wellness was a big part of it. Why do we only reimburse because you're sick? Why do we only reimburse based on a diagnosis? Why can't we focus on being well and staying well? And obviously, if you have a diagnosis, there might be other areas of your life that you want to focus on as well. And why do we only need to focus on, that diagnosis that basically is going to, that's going to be getting reimbursed?
You make a good point. Like, are we in the business of health or are we in the business of sickness?
Yeah,
right? Well, the healthcare system, but you make some really good points about why are we providing the services when there's a diagnosis versus being proactive instead of reactive.
Yeah, I've heard, this is not my term. I've heard it called sick care versus healthcare. And mm-hmm. that is what we're living in.
Mm-hmm. Now that's how, and that's how you became interested in health and wellness, because you were helping students with a clinic that provided mental health services. How did you decide to become an OT if we went one kind of step backwards?
Yeah. I would say, obviously, I'd say for most of us, this OT journey is a personal journey. So OT was like a third career for me. So I was working in the corporate world. I have no problem putting my business out there. I was married. This was my first marriage, and I was miserable. I was really unhappy. I was really not taking care of myself. I wasn't eating well. I had body pain. I was working way too many hours. And then I was unhappy in my personal relationships. And I basically was, you know, working in a corporate environment. And so I decided that I had a bachelor's degree in biology, but then I went into finance and corporate quality assurance. And so I decided I wanted to go back to my science roots. I absolutely loved my studies, but I didn't do too much with it. I did work at a behavioral health nonprofit as a counselor, but I couldn't afford to live in San Francisco. I think, you know, most of the country is expensive, but San Francisco is ultra expensive. It's up there with New York City. So I lots of different things kind of happened in my life. I had lost a family member to an illness that could have been prevented if he had better insurance. And so I just kind of knew that it was time for me to do something different. I had to start taking better care of myself. And I looked at what my options are. And there's not too much you can do with a bachelor's degree in biology. So I knew that I had to go back to school. I knew that I wanted to help people. And then I also knew that I had to be able to make a living so that I could continue to live in San Francisco. And the reality is, I didn't really know what OT was. My nephew, when he was really young, had hand therapy, but that didn't really register. And so I thought I wanted to look at maybe becoming a physical therapist. And so in the process of looking at PT schools and doing the hours, I found occupational therapy. So then I didn't have too many courses that I needed to do to apply to school because I already had like a, you know, like pre-med bio degree. So I just had to update some things and I had to do my hours. So I was like, let me do PT and OT at the same time so I can, you know, make sure that I'm making the right decision. This is like a third career for me. I don't want to make any mistakes. And I remember this vividly. I was in the hospital and physical therapy had discharged a patient. And then occupational therapy went in, saw the patient and was like, okay, if the patient can walk, whatever it was, 300 feet or something like that with a walker, but they can't turn corners. So they're not going to be able to go home safely. And I was like, this is it for me. Like if it's holistic, you're looking at everything. You're like, this person's not going to be safe. Wait, you know, you're basically looking at everything. And that's, you know, my mind is everywhere all the time. So that was really it for me with occupational therapy. And, you know, I can fast forward, basically worked mostly in hospital settings. And my background, I am, you know, I'm South Asian. My parents are from India and what's now Bangladesh. It was colonized. It was India before when they were living there. And I was raised with things like meditation, which, you know, mainstream is mindfulness. And I was raised with doing like yoga, yogic breathing and yoga type exercises and traditional healing. So using herbs, using Ayurveda, if you had any kind of pain or any kind of issues, you had like your grandma or your mom or somebody recommending, okay, do this, try this, versus taking prescription medications that you might need to take for the rest of your life. You know, it was really focused on your body and things that you could access from nature, things that you can do for yourself versus taking pharmaceuticals. And so, you know, that part was not anything other than, I guess, maybe mindfulness in mental health settings, but the roots of it were left out. And so when I started to, you know, come up with my own programs, I'm like, why can't we offer a little bit of ourselves in our services, right? Why can't we talk about the things that work for us, that mean something to us, rather than kind of giving this like one size fits all prescription? Even though we're OTs, we kind of really only have, you know, a certain amount of things that we can access in our toolbox if we're maintaining professionalism, if we're looking at strictly evidence-based things that are in the OT realm.
Yeah. Oh, wow. This is deep. You know, I'm listening to all, I was listening to everything you're saying, and there's so much that just resonates with me. I do want to say thank you for being transparent about your background and sharing, because I think that stories are impactful, and there might be listeners who have had similar backgrounds and are inspired by you and your ability to, you know, press through different challenges and seek roles and positions where you feel that your health and your wellness is really being fostered. So yeah. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. We're often taught, as occupational therapists that if, you know, there's the therapeutic use of self, but it stops at when you go too far. Right. And right. So what I found in mental health practice, and I'm sure you can relate to this, is if you are vulnerable, then the person you're working with is willing to be vulnerable. If you give a little bit of yourself, and either they can relate to it, or maybe even if they can't relate to it, they trust you more. And so, you know, I'm a human just like you. Why do I have to pretend like my life is perfect? Why do I have to erase what I have been through? Because it might help you in the process.
Exactly. And the other thing you said about, you know, evidence, specific evidence. And I just recently had a conversation with another OT with the previous podcast show, and we were talking about qualified. What does it mean to be qualified? Mm-hmm. That just made me think of that when you said evidence. What is evidence? You know, and your personal experience and the shared lived experience that you have with others, I think, is a form of evidence and a form of expertise. Now, whether or not it's perceived by the majority is another question. And I can relate to what you're saying in terms of what is considered taboo. Well, that's too much. Wait a minute, reel it back. Versus that's professional for you to say that, or that's within your professional way of practicing. So yeah, it's just a lot of food for thought. I'm trying to just process all what you just said about that, because I think that it is very subjective. And if it's coming from the majority in our profession, then I think it can really suppress some authenticity, which I consider the ability to use your experiences as evidence, and really be more impactful for the diverse population that we serve.
Right. Yeah. We live in a very diverse country. And so, you know, that's a thing, you know, talking about evidence and the majority, the reality is we have to question, you know, I don't want to take us too far on a tangent, but we really do have to question, who decides, what is researched? Who decides what is approved? Who decides who are the research subjects and what the topics are, right? You know, often it's guided by certain people. Things that make it into journals, they are, you know, they're peer reviewed, they're often edited, they're often, you know, rejected if they don't meet a certain criteria. It's like, who's making that stuff up? Does it really represent the majority? I completely disagree, but like, that's a whole nother conversation.
Exactly. That is a series just in the subjectivity of certain words that we use: professional, qualified, right, evidence. How are we defining those terms, and who are defining those terms?
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. So talk to us about your leadership roles, your current entrepreneurial roles and your leadership roles, because there's some things in this bio I was looking for. I was like, okay, Sheila is humble like many of the guests who come on the show. But I know that you have just really taken off in terms of leadership in our profession in many ways. So can you talk to us about some of those roles?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, outside of running my business, you know, within my business, I mentioned to you briefly before we started recording, you know, I do work in my community. I offer like pro bono and like free monthly groups, bringing community members together and offering, you know, free educational services for wellness, because I really don't think that you should be able to only afford access to knowledge that can help you take better care of yourself. But within the OT realm, I am a board member of a mental health occupational therapy nonprofit that serves youth in San Francisco. It's the occupational therapy training program in San Francisco. I am also on the steering committee of the Psychiatric Occupational Therapy Action Coalition. So that is, it is mostly on the West Coast, but it's really open to anybody in the US. So if you are a psych or mental health OT, it's really, you know, it is action oriented, which I really appreciate. So, you know, everyone's a volunteer and just kind of getting down into advocating for psych OT services. And with them, I helped start a equity, diversity, and inclusion collaborative. And we did, earlier this year, we did a dismantling white supremacy and occupational therapy workshop. It was like a 3-hour workshop. And I think we had close to 70 participants actually from all over the world. We had people waking up at like 4 a.m. from Australia to attend, people from the UK, and obviously mostly US-based OTs and students. And I am also in my city, I am on the committee for police alternatives. So we just wrapped up a bunch of basically recommendations for the city. So San Francisco has actually divested, you know, I'm not going to say the number because I don't want to say it wrong. I'm forgetting right now exactly how much it is, but a significant amount of, you know, millions in funding from the police department to go into like upstream services. And so this committee was really focused on what can we do to serve the needs of our unhoused people in San Francisco versus having the police called on them? What are some things that police are called for when there can be alternatives in place so that there is no police violence, so that people aren't being, you know, incarcerated when they shouldn't be or going through the system when they shouldn't be? You know, what can we do to minimize the harm to, you know, predominantly Black and brown people, right? That this is happening to, and working in mental health, you know that there just isn't enough understanding. There just isn't enough training. And so people within the community don't know what to do. They call the police. Police obviously are not mental health workers. They're not equipped to deal with these situations. And so why should it be them responding first versus people that know how to, you know, communicate with humanity and try to figure out, okay, what do you need in this moment versus how do I get you out of this situation and, you know, keep everybody else safe and lock you up, which that, you know, that whole thinking is flawed.
Oh yeah. Yeah. As a mom of two Black males, certainly appreciate the work that you're doing. It needs to be more widespread across the U.S.
Yes. Agreed.
I don't think there's a day that goes by that I don't think about some of these, stories and issues and things that they may have to face if they get pulled over by the police. So I had no idea you were doing that. You're, you know, you're in the community, you're advocating, you're focusing on action. How do you, and then, you know, the example you gave of the workshop where you brought all these people together, what do you do to enter into these spaces and connect with so many different people to move towards action? What do you attribute to the success in doing so?
Yeah. So, you know, again, I am a full disclosure person. So kind of person. So I actually was involved with my state association's DEI. It also volunteer, you know, all these leadership things I mentioned, they're all unpaid, right? You do this because you want to do this. And I just dropped out of that because I spent a year with an amazing team and we came up, you know, we worked our butts off and we came up with these really great initiatives and everything was just hurry up and wait. And so, you know, a lot of these initiatives you can get on just by seeking them out, right? You say who you are, what you have to offer, especially if you're a member of the community, you know, you have like a vested personal interest in improving things. And, you know, you're not getting paid. So they're happy to have you. You know, some things require an application process, but you know, if your heart is really in it and you have something to offer, chances are you should be able to do it, or not do it, but make your way in. But I would say the biggest thing of like making this successful and you know, making any progress is taking care of yourself first and like really thinking about what you need. Because a lot of this work, whether it's at like a community level or a bigger level, there's a lot of bureaucracy, especially with like anti-racism type work. You know, DEI is the popular terminology because it's a catch-all. A lot of people are doing it because they kind of have to do it. And those things don't really get very far. And that's why I dropped out of that commitment with my state association. So it kind of goes both ways. Like if you want to be involved, you also want to vet, you know, what do these people stand for? Is there a budget? Am I going to have power to do anything? Mm-hmm. Because if I'm going to be dedicating my time to doing this work and it's just so you can say that you had this committee and you listened to them, but you didn't do anything about it. What, you know, really what's the point? And so, you know, I try to associate myself with initiatives that actually take action, right? Where I am working on things and you can see them into fruition versus just you make a recommendation and you hope they listen to you.
Mm. Yeah, you asked some great questions. Is there a budget for this? What actions are going to be taken? And you said a phrase earlier, hurry up and wait. And I hadn't heard that term before, but if I'm interpreting it correctly, it's basically putting an emphasis more on be patient. And at some point, we're going to get to it in the future. And you're wondering,
yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah, it's hurry up and wait is I'm demanding from you that you give me what I'm asking for. But then the part that I'm accountable for, you need to wait on that. And yeah. Oh, wow. And so it, you know, it's the effort isn't mutual. It is demanding a lot more from you. And there's likely, you know, no accountability, no transparency.
Yeah. And you're saying, if I'm going to hurry up, I want to see reciprocity. I want, yeah. So I want the action. And so speaking of action, I asked if we could talk about Disrupt OT, because I'm like, this was a big deal. I was right in the heart of finishing up my doctoral studies, as well as launching, working with faculty and launching a new program, getting my son back to school. There's a lot of moving parts when it went on, but I was following it and very impressed with how you pulled it together. Can we talk about how did you do this? Where did the idea come from and how did you do it?
Yes. And I do want to take a step back and thank you for your support. I know that was a really busy time for you and you weren't going to be able to make it. But I appreciate you supporting the event and, you know, basically being a part of making sure it happened. So yeah, I guess I left Disrupt OT off. That was a pretty big action-oriented initiative. So, you know, it's funny because if you ask me, okay, where did this start from? It's like, it probably started the day I started OT school, right? This resonates with some people, obviously not everyone, but everything I learned in OT school and a lot of what I was taught, you know, in practical training just really didn't resonate with me and how I was brought up. I was like, okay, like I get what you're saying, but this only works for certain people. And so, you know, I've even seen it. My mom had a stroke last year, and she had an OT come to the house. And my mom is good, because she will tell you straight up, like, why are you asking me to do this? Instead of, you know, instead of just being like, okay, let's do this. My mom will be like, what's the point of this? I don't do that, you know? And so just kind of back to that conversation about evidence-based, like, there is, you know, you say majority, but maybe majority in the U.S., right? Like, majority of OTs in the United States are white, right? At about 84%. But occupational therapy is a worldwide profession. So the global majority is not white. Right. The global majority looks like me and you, and everybody else. They speak multiple languages. They eat in different ways. They live in different ways. Their community is different. And those people also live where we serve occupational therapy services in this majority white profession in the U.S. Right. So Disrupt OT was just my frustration, like the culmination of my frustration with everything in occupational therapy, the education, the training, the lack of diversity in literature. Like, why is everything in English? There are authors who have, you know, a primary language that isn't English that are writing amazing work. Like social occupational therapy, for example, has been in South America for, I'm like forgetting if it's 30 years plus. Like I mentioned to you, I'm a little off this morning, but it's been decades. And so it's just coming to light in, you know, in the United States, kind of Australia, Canada, UK, but it's been around for decades, right? You know, I have a colleague, friend, Jaime Leite Jr. in Brazil, who is an occupational therapist. And he's like, OT isn't just medical model. Like, we have OTs that are like working on societal issues, and that's what they do. And they're not worried about medical reimbursements, and they have nothing at all to do with rehab and anything related to the medical model. And they've been doing that for decades. And that's the norm there. And so I'm just like, okay, OTs are doing these wonderful things all around the world. OTs are doing things that seem like they are like emerging areas of practice, but they've actually been around for a long time. They just haven't been, they're not something that we are getting access to in our OT education, at least in the United States. And I really don't see our OT institutions, AOTA, and the like doing much about really bringing to light all the wonderful things that have been happening. It's kind of, people are taking credit for like DEI work, and that is supposed to be progressive. So I was like, okay, let me get the people that I know that are doing amazing things together, and let's just put it out there. Let's not have any gatekeeping. Let's let people just, you know, put their ideas, their thoughts, their opinions out there. And I didn't realize that there was a huge community that felt the way that I did, and realized that all of this is, again, really just really lacking in education and training. And so we had panels, we used Twitter to have conversations. We had what we called community gathering, just using Zoom to get people together from different parts of the world to interact with one another. We had healing sessions. We talked about decolonization, anti-racism, gender, sexuality, how to build community, looked at mental health from different global perspectives. And you know, it's still going. Like it's turned into a movement, and we are going to have a lot more things going with it. I am hoping to find a way to turn it into a nonprofit, because for me, it's really important not to exploit people. I know you know this because you are one of the people that is constantly doing the work, and you're doing a lot of work for free. And sometimes it's expected of you. Mm-hmm. And so part of this initiative was to not exploit people. And at the same time, I also wanted to make sure that all of this information was available to people without barriers. So I was able to manage getting every one of our speakers paid. They were paid equally. And we were able to make the whole event completely free to anybody that wanted to access it.
That is phenomenal.
It was not easy, right? So I just kind of expected that we would have, like, why wouldn't people want to sponsor this? We had like 1,500 people signed up for this. So why wouldn't, you know, say AOTA say, hey, I want to support this. Like, this is amazing. This is amazing work. And why wouldn't we want to compensate one of the speakers for doing this labor? And so I had to rely on the community and mutual aid. And so, you know, people like you, even OT students pitched in to make sure that every single person was compensated for their labor. Because we're going to do this differently. We're not going to take advantage of people's, it's emotional labor, right? It's a lot of time. It takes a lot out of you, and people were bearing their souls, you know?
Yeah. And to be able to ensure that every speaker got paid, but at the same time that there were no financial barriers to people who wanted to participate. Yeah. That's phenomenal. I definitely can relate to wanting to provide services and having that balance between pay versus what's going to be available to people for free. And I said this in a previous podcast, which should have aired by the time we're airing this one, that I went through this, I had this epiphany about just the lack of resources available to people of color and how profound it is in terms of entrepreneurship. And I know you posted some about that, Sheila, and I posted an article this past Friday on LinkedIn about just the whole access to capital and continue to make a commitment to providing affordable and free resources to people who would otherwise be shut out from those opportunities. And so are people still able to access Disrupt OT, or is that something that will be available annually?
Yeah. So actually we just met to talk about like the original volunteers and speakers. We just met to talk about how to proceed forward. And we are just about, not just about to, but we're finally going to work through the recordings. We did record the panels, and we're going to make those accessible to people. Again, freely, anybody that wants to on YouTube, but we needed to pause and let people think about if they're okay with sharing this information. You know, we forget. You and I live in a country which, you know, again, it depends on who you are. Maybe we don't all have the same safeties of being able to say what we want publicly and not to have any kind of retribution, right? And so this was a global thing, and people talked about topics that could get them fired, that could have the government investigate them, could possibly even result in violence towards them. And so we really needed to pause and make sure, do we want to put everything out there so publicly, right? Once something is out on the internet, you can't take it back. You know, for the most part, everyone has agreed. So we will be doing some editing, but we're hoping to do some like regular sessions. So if you're on Twitter, please follow @DisruptOT. But we are hoping to do some regular sessions, you know, having some tweet ups is basically conversations. So we'll probably be, you know, assigning like podcasts and papers and having discussions on Twitter. But we're hoping to do some regular forums, like the panels that, you know, you were talking about. We did the Black OT entrepreneurs, I'd say successful Black OT entrepreneurs that you were a panelist for. And so similar to that, doing panels and discussions that are free and open to people that want to gain that knowledge and maybe have some interest and want to ask some questions. So it's not just like a one-way webinar, but people can engage, because this is all about action, right? Like, how do we change things up? How do we challenge the status quo? And so we're trying to do more of that. But again, I'm really mindful of, okay, I want this to be sustainable. Right now, like I dedicated well over 1,000 hours of my time to this, right? So I don't want to put that on anybody else, and I don't want to keep asking for free labor. So trying to figure that out.
Okay. Yeah. I don't want to say that you certainly have skill sets that are important for in order to be a successful entrepreneur. Obviously, you're already an entrepreneur, but you mentioned a nonprofit. And so as I was listening to you, having founded a very small nonprofit, it's like, wow, you got the leadership skills to create an amazing nonprofit, because you do have to know how to network with people when you are a nonprofit founder or on the board, but also to raise money. And any assistance you need with that, if you decide to start a nonprofit, let me know. I am available to, I'd be more than happy to help support that. The other thing I wanted to ask you, Sheila, you know, about people putting themselves out there and speaking up. You don't hesitate. You know, seeing some of your posts. And I'm just wondering, how did you get to a point where you're just like, I'm just going to say what I feel needs to be said without worrying about how it may be perceived? Or maybe you do. I don't know if what comes across your mind. I'm making some assumptions, but I know that you have been very bold in how you have addressed certain things. And the issue you mentioned earlier about, you know, people could get fired, or there, you know, there's different consequences that can happen based on what you say. All too often I talk to OTs who say, I'm just going to keep quiet. You know, I just got to get through this because I don't know how it's going to be perceived if I speak up. And I'm really just speaking up, but that can be interpreted in many different ways. And the backlash sometimes is very difficult and challenging for people, particularly people who have had previous experiences where the outcome was not positive. So can you talk about how you got to this space to be able to be bold?
Yeah. You know, and what you mentioned, what you were mentioning, it also makes me think of, there are some of us that have extra consequences, right? For extra negative consequences for speaking up. Like, two people can say the same thing, but depending on what they look like, the consequences are different, right? Let's be honest. Like, I have a level of privilege that allows me to be able to speak this way. I grew up and I still live in a very liberal, and compared to at least the way that I was raised, the demographics have significantly shifted in the past 20 years. But I live in a very like racially diverse, diverse place. I was raised in a very diverse place where I could speak up. I'm fortunate that my mom is somebody who speaks up and really speaks out against injustices. I really did try to think about it for a second. I was like, okay, wait, where did this start? Because I have always been just a loud-mouthed child. My parents almost encouraged debate, you know, like for me to think for myself, for me to advocate for, if I want something, why do I want it? Why is it important? My mom and dad my dad passed away, but my parents are immigrants, and they gave other people in the immigrant community opportunities. So they gave people chances because they knew that they believed in them. They knew that they could become something in this country. And so I think part of that immigrant experience is, you also like, you need to stand up for your people, because there is a lot of discrimination. And I think from early on, you know, my parents had accents. My mom refused to dress like an American, right? I actually didn't even learn English until I started school. My mom refused to speak English with me in the house. She wore her traditional clothing. She was proud of who she was, and she didn't care if she was in another country and you're supposed to look a certain way. And so people weren't always nice to them. Even as a kid, I would defend my parents. And my mom never stopped me. She never told me that I had to be quiet or respectful to somebody older than me because I was doing the right thing. I was telling them that they were being inappropriate, that they were wrong, that they needed to back off. So I think I was just like empowered from early on. Like, I couldn't do this if I grew up in India. That's the reality. As a woman, I couldn't get away with saying what I wanted to, with speaking my mind, because I grew up going to India every year too. And so I get into lots of trouble. And I also, you know, just within the community, sometimes would be harassed for just being myself. And so I recognize that for the most part, I can say what I want, I can do what I want, I can be who I want, and I'm going to survive it, right? I don't have any fear of violence against me. I am in a place where I have the freedom as a brown woman to speak up, to tell people if they're doing something wrong. Obviously, you know, sometimes there are safety issues. I've had for doing the right thing and what I think is saying the right thing, I have had violence threatened against me, but, you know, mostly like somebody threatened to punch me or something like that. So I kept, you know, then I would keep my mouth shut. But for the most part, it's privilege. I have the privilege to say what I want. I have the privilege to speak up. I'm safe here.
Yeah. And so it sounds like you recognize certain privilege, but also that you've had a very strong role model in your life who modeled these and exercised these freedoms. So what advice would you give to someone who wants to speak up, but they feel like they'll get backlash from being authentic and vocal about some of these issues?
Yeah, I would say like safety first, right? You know, you do want to make sure that you aren't attacked or that you won't lose your job, right? Not everybody can afford that situation if that happens. And so you have to think through the consequences, of course. But, you know, the next thing would be like, find your community, find your people. So, you know, often we feel alone in the situations that we're experiencing. Often we're like, wait, this isn't right. Is it just me that's experiencing it? Is it only happening here? And, you know, the reality is no, it's happening in lots of other places. So if you find your community of people that maybe think like you, maybe look like you, maybe have similar experiences as you, then you have safety there. Maybe you don't have to shout it out to your manager, or, you know, like me, out into all of the internet or social media. But, you know, maybe you can speak your truth with your people, and maybe they can guide you through how you can best handle a situation, so you're really not alone in it. And you know, I've created these spaces, I'm parts of these spaces, and you don't have to meet these people to like really feel connected to them.
That's great advice, because with support and community, there's power. And I think that whole shared lived experience, particularly when people are sharing about how they have successfully been able to have a voice, can just make a huge difference in the lives of people feeling like I'm completely alone and I have no choice but to keep it quiet and keep moving, which is, in terms, you know, thinking about health and wellness, that can take a huge toll on your health and wellness. Even if you're saying I'm going through the motions and I'm getting it done and I'm being strong with it, from a physiological standpoint and mental health standpoint, I think that things are happening when there's that disconnect between what you really want to do and what you're actually doing.
Yeah, definitely. There's power, and there's also like part of that power, you know, you don't have to speak up. I do have to add that you don't have to, you know, sometimes it's a personality thing, you know, a big part is that it has to be safe to be able to do so. But sometimes maybe you can just leave that situation, right? And protect yourself. Yeah. Maybe you can just pause and figure out how to take care of yourself. So, I mean, that's what community does. It takes that weight off of you because it's no longer just your burden to bear.
Yeah. Good point. And I love that you're speaking about the diversity and how people approach things, because I think sometimes dealt with this recently, where if there are leaders who are very vocal and they have, you know, a certain identity, when they meet another person who has that identity, they think you're supposed to do the exact same thing as the other person. You know, if this person respond vocally and bold, then you're supposed to respond vocally and bold. There's differences within diverse, you know, there's
yes.
like all people who are of Asian descent who are leaders are not the same. All Black OT leaders are not the same, and the approaches are different. I tend to be a person who's very quiet and action oriented. And I've had people, you know, kind of look at me like, well, what are you doing? And what are you saying about this? And making a comparison to the way someone else approaches. I'm like, there's diversity in Black people. There's diversity yes. in leadership. There's diversity in people of Asian descent. There's diversity in people who are identified as Hispanic or Latinx. And sometimes because you don't see as many, you make an assumption that we all approach things the exact same way. Which is not the case.
I totally agree. And, you know, each method has its own power and impact. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I cannot stress enough, like, everybody thinks that in order to make an impact, you have to move something forward. And if you aren't stepping back and taking care of yourself and making sure you're whole, like, you not even being able to persist in the profession is an impact. So it is 100% okay to not be on a board, not start a nonprofit, not start a movement, not speak up, and just take care of yourself and sustain yourself so that you are, you know, pushing or maintaining that dial in those diversity numbers, right? Like, we don't want you to drop off because you're just completely burned out because you felt pressure to do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah, that's very powerful. We need you.
Exactly. Need you. Yeah. And it is an action to sustain yourself and not have to do anything else.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. And like, sometimes even silence is what's needed at a particular time. And so I'm saying silence in that you're doing internal work, because it takes a lot to process some of these experiences. You mentioned meditation earlier, and sometimes you have to take a step back. You asked me earlier about, you know, what are you doing, Tamiko? Because you do all these different things. I'm like, silence is a big priority for me right now in the morning, and really trying to process certain experiences and stories. I hear a lot of stories as a Black OT who predominantly has Black female OT aspiring entrepreneur clients, and that it can be heavy. Okay, so we're coming to a close. I think we've kind of, you know, went on some tangents, but I'm looking at the questions and you really answered most of the questions. So I'd like to ask, you know, what's next for you and how can we support you in your future endeavors?
Yeah, so, you know, I am always trying to make a bigger impact. And you know, I know we're wrapping up, but I have to say this. I do need to take a step back based on that last piece that you said. So for me, I can do this out loud. I can do this openly. The inner work is actually a lot harder for me. So I will be honest about that. Like, actually pausing and stopping, you know, doing nothing in the sense of just like sitting with things in myself, that's actually harder for me to do. So I, you know, I do me, right? And so bigger impact is my next goal. So like I said, I'm hoping to turn Disrupt OT into a nonprofit. I was already hoping to start a nonprofit before COVID, and then COVID hit. I was trying to do that in my local community. So now I'm trying to go community, both local and global. And I am hoping, I'm really going to start slowing down the end of this year with my professional work. I don't know about like a lot of the leadership stuff. It's hard to slow that down when there's momentum, but I really want to create a health equity app. So, you know, like you, social entrepreneurship is important to me, and done a lot of community-based work. And I really want to tackle some of the bigger issues, some of the like upstream problems. And so I'm hoping, my husband's a software engineer, so I'm hoping to either start that next year, or maybe if I can get what I need together to create the app by the end of this year.
That's impressive, Sheila. You just have all these different things. I told you when I read that bio. There's so much more to Sheila. We probably didn't even cover everything in this short time. We certainly know that you are a leader and that you're an entrepreneur. You're an advocate and you are action oriented. And we thank you for all that you're doing for our profession to make it a better profession for all the people around the world who are practicing in diverse ways. I'm glad you made the point about outside of the U.S. Yeah. We have practitioners who look like us. We have more practitioners who look like us. We just don't necessarily see it here in the U.S. as well as the difference in how we practice with right. the emphasis on social occupational therapy outside of the U.S. more so than we see here. Like we're kind of just, I feel like moving in that direction, yep. whereas you said in, did you say South America for past
South
30
America.
Years? Yes, past
mm-hmm.
30 years. So that's all really enlightening and just definitely something for me to continue to think about and just encourages me to continue to support you. So whatever you're doing, please keep me in the loop. I will make sure that I am sharing more so than I probably did during the time that you were reaching out to me. And yeah, I am so serious about the nonprofit. If you get to a point where you need any assistance with starting that nonprofit up, I would like to be available. And I say to the audience, please follow Sheila. We'll put some links in the bio and pay attention. She is a mover and a shaker. Thank you again, Sheila, so much for your time.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Don't forget to follow. Until next time.